I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. When I was young, among my parents' friends was a certain family named Mize. Tom Mize was a postal worker, but before carrying the mail, he had been a military man, a ship's cook, actually. The Mize family and our family were very close. And 20 years before my birth, Tom had been captured in the Philippines by the Japanese after the fall of Corregidor in World War II. From May of 42 until the end of hostilities in August of 45, Tom was held a prisoner of war. I knew absolutely nothing about his status as a former POW because he never spoke of it. He seemed a cheerful man. He liked a good laugh and almost always wore a smile. My parents said that he never, ever spoke in their company of his incarceration. Only his wife, Lucy, ever offered anything in the way of detail. I guess the memories were too painful, and her descriptions of his suffering actually left little to the imagination. My parents told me a little bit about that. I seem to remember stories of Tom having night terrors. Today we talk of PTSD, but that terminology really didn't exist when I was young. Now, let's switch gears just a little bit here. I want you to imagine that you are not Tom, not a soldier, not a ship's cook. Imagine that you are a nurse in the U.S. Navy, and you, too, are taken captive in the Philippines during the selfsame years of World War II. Imagine the trauma you might experience through that ordeal. Would it be enough to keep you pretty silent about things? But imagine that this silence, perhaps self-imposed after your release, imagine that that silence is compounded by the U.S. military instructing you that you mustn't say anything about it, or at least that you must downplay what you've been through. By any accounting, that seems like an additional violence. There's a story of suffering, but also a story of immense courage that we're going to explore now on Constant Wonder. Navy nurses stationed in the Philippines in 1940 began their work in a place that was described to them as something of a paradise. Beautiful weather, fabulous dances, social opportunities to hobnob with officers and maybe even date them. Then comes Pearl Harbor, and immediately thereafter, the Japanese assault on the Philippines. That's the setting for our story. Our guest now on Constant Wonder is Emily Lebeau Lucchese. Her work has been carried in the New York Times, The Atlantic Online, and Discover magazine. She has contributed more than 800 stories to the Chicago Tribune. Her PhD is from the University of Illinois Chicago. And today we're going to talk about her book, This Is Really War, The Incredible True Story of a Navy Nurse POW in the Occupied Philippines. Emily Lebeau Lucchese, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Are we really going to talk about things that many female nurses, after having been POWs, that they were told not to talk about?
Yeah, we are going to take it. When they came home, they were treated like girls coming home from camp. And if you look at the old news stories, particularly the ones written by the Army Press Corps, they were treated like they had been roughing it. And it was so much more oppressive than it was pretended to be. And so that's what we're going to talk about, how these women endured and were truly American heroes.
I don't want to just like say too much too soon about this, but where do you suppose that came from, this instruction to downplay it or say it was a great summer at camp?
Right. Well, a couple things. I mean, at the time, the U.S. military was not really set up to handle mental illness or to handle any type of mental trauma. And after World War I, the U.S. military had to really invest a lot of money in the ongoing care of the wounded, both mentally and physically. So they were very much structured to dismiss anybody who might potentially show these symptoms and to not, you know, bring them aboard. And so that was part of it. Another part of it was that it was thought that it would be better for the nurses if they were told not to talk about it, if they weren't seen as prisoners of war who endured trauma. So they were really positioned as these witnesses to the trauma instead of participants, and it was thought that they would avoid any type of stigma. Because at that point, you know, the U.S. was realizing that U.S. military who had been captured by the Japanese endured all sorts of horrific trauma. And there was going to be a stigma attached, whether that person had, you know, physical or mental ailments as a result of their captivity. So we saw that the nurses could avoid this. And this was really quite easy for them to do because people assumed that suffering was for the men, right? That it didn't happen to women, that nursing actually insulated women from the horrors of war. But we certainly know that is not true.
So the category POW, that was reserved for the soldiers. The nurses did not get categorized at that for the American public.
Right. So it's interesting, too, because General MacArthur, when he toured the civilian POW camps, he said these are not internment camps. These are concentration camps. And he was furious. But the word internee was used for civilians and for these nurses, but they were certainly prisoners of war. They'd be on the prisoner of war rosters, right? If you search any of those rosters, you'll always see the women listed on the prisoner of war rosters. But then in newspaper articles, when they were asked to speak, they were designated as internees.
So the terminology is kind of weird to play with here, but you're saying that civilian POWs are different from military POWs?
Well, yeah. And so to put it, this is the best way to describe it, is statistically. So if you were, to give you a frame of reference, and these are statistics from the U.S. military, if you were a sailor or Marine in World War II, and you were taken prisoner of war by the Germans, you had a 1% chance of dying in that prisoner of war camp. If you were a prisoner of war taken by the Japanese, you had a 40% chance of dying in that prison of war camp. If you were a civilian taken prisoner of war, you had an 11% chance of dying, and that is only because they did not massacre them all before the U.S. and Filipino allies got to these inmates. So in the book, I use the word inmate or prisoner as opposed to internee because they were towards the end of the war, they were there to die.
And the Japanese were actually poised to execute prisoners, and it was right down to the wire.
Oh my gosh, yeah. It was, I mean, they were liberated on the morning about 6 hours before the Japanese planned to massacre the entire camp. It was about 2,400 at Los Baños was the prison camp where the Navy nurses were transferred. And I actually have the memo was given to me of the intelligence saying this needs to happen today because we believe it's going to happen today. And so what had happened the day before on February 22nd, 1945, is that the Japanese guards set up guns around the camp and turned the barrels inward. And they also began digging trenches. So at this point, the inmates suspect there's going to be a massacre and they're trading strategies. Should we play dead? Should we try to run into the jungle, you know, get through the barbed wire and run into the jungle? And when the liberation began, the subject of my book, the Navy nurse, Dorothy Still, she actually thought the massacre had begun, and she grabbed an infant with plans to run into the jungle.
I'm glad you mentioned Dorothy. It's time to talk about her story, yeah. And she is the pivotal figure that you use for the perspective on all of this. How did you decide that Dorothy's story would be the one?
So I found her memoir in my local library. I'm a pretty heavy user of the local library, and I had found it on the top shelf, and it was out of print. She wrote it in the 1990s, and the Naval Institute Press printed it, and you can still find it on Amazon. It's called What a Way to Spend a War, but you will find that she changed everybody's names, and she softened it. She went with that girls from camp type of point of view. But it allowed me to put her into different places within the war and then to react to certain events. And then after that, I found oral histories as she gave this immense 70,000 word oral history to the Bureau, the Navy's Bureau of Medicine and Surgery, to their historian. And so I had a couple options. There was her, another nurse, Peg Nash from Pennsylvania, who is very, very spirited. But I felt really compelled to Dorothy's story. She was just 27 years old when she was taken prisoner of war. And she had been told, I found out from her son, by a naval psychiatrist after the war, that she was not eligible for mental health treatment because she was a woman and a nurse, and therefore he believed she did not suffer. And at the time, you know, she was crying easily without provocation. She was depressed a lot. And her fiance had said, see if you can get a discharge, a medical discharge. And she was refused. And it really, really shut her up. And so I wanted to take it and write the book that she would have written if that psychiatrist had not gotten inside her head.
Yeah.
And her family was very helpful to me.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to before Pearl Harbor and what these nurses expected to be in the way of their experience as Navy nurses. And before we get into that, because there's, I don't know if I characterized it accurately. I mean, it's to go far from home and work in the heat of the Philippines is, you know, I don't want to pretend that that's a summer vacation to begin with. But there was kind of this feeling that this would be a fairly easy assignment, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah. No, you described it accurately. Dorothy, when she was told that she was being transferred to the Philippines, she was from Southern California. She was very anxious. And other nurses said, oh, no, this is a great assignment. She was leaving in 1939, right? So this is before the hostilities involving the U.S. And she was told she would have half-day shifts because of the heat. So there'd be plenty of time for tennis and golf and swimming and dates with officers. And she was told to pack plenty of party dresses. And she did, which is not helpful in a prisoner of war camp.
Well, I'm going to just jump ahead. Those dresses eventually became bandages?
Yes. Oh, these women were amazing, right? These 12 nurses, the 12 anchors, they were amazing because they are transferred from the prison camp in Manila. They agree to go to Los Baños, which is a countryside camp. They're going to be the only women. 800 men are going. And if they don't go, there will be no medical care providers. And so they agree to go. And they have to build up this infirmary. So they're doing all sorts of really, you know, they had such great ingenuity. You know, they were using these party dresses as bandages, tree sap to make adhesive for the bandages. They were really smart in how they set up this infirmary, and they saved many lives as a result.
Now, you mentioned 12 nurses. I realize that's the core group of people that you zero in on. Do you have any sense for how many nurses all told were prisoners of war in the Philippines?
Yeah. So there are 66 Army nurses and then these 12 Navy nurses. And they were the ones who were prisoner of war. The Army nurses had been on Bataan and Corregidor. And some of them were actually evacuated to safety, and then 66 were taken prisoner of war and transferred to the prison camp in about, you know, August of 42 in Manila. And so there they joined the Navy nurses, and they worked side by side until about May of 43. And that's when the Navy nurses agreed to transfer. And then there was also a handful of civilian nurses that were helping in the infirmary in Manila.
The title of your book, This Is Really War, to whom should we attribute that phrase?
That is Nurse Peg Nash. And she was such a spirited woman. So many of the book chapters come from her. And she's actually, in the moments of levity in the book come from her because she's funny. And she was assigned to the same ward as Dorothy Still. And after the bombing of Manila, which happened just a few days after Pearl Harbor, they had hid during the bombing. And when the all clear sounded, the nurses ran to the Naval Hospital. And Dorothy and Peg walked into their ward, and the casualties had already arrived. And they're seeing all sorts of burns and limbs that have been blown off and dislocations and absolutely, positively terrible, open, gushing wounds. And Nurse Peg says, "Oh my God, this is really war." She got the title.
So to call it a paradigm shift is... Mm-hmm. A little bit weak, isn't it?
In terms of
the shift that had to go on in these nurses' mind, because if they're bringing party dresses and thinking about tennis and swimming, yeah,
they were really unprepared. They weren't prepared to begin with. They had no training, right? So when Dorothy Still applied to be a Navy nurse, she wrote out an application, and she was told to report to the Naval Hospital by the end of 1937, and that she had no training. So they certainly weren't prepared for war. One of Dorothy's primary responsibilities had been overseeing the men who were put into the Iron Lung. So those are very sick patients, not combat casualties. So, yeah, it was in a moment. And you see them overwhelmed. And you see them feeling guilt for not being able to do more, particularly the moments when someone was dying and they couldn't comfort them. But they absolutely had no training. And then they had no training to prepare to care for immensely emaciated patients.
Yeah. Well, you know, we could talk about the care of the patients, but we were going to have to fold in as well the fact that these nurses themselves are victims, and the fact that institutionally the military wanted them to downplay their own victimhood. We're going to get into that a little bit more, but I also want to talk about their courage and how they rallied together. We're going to do it after a very short break here on Constant Wonder. We are visiting with Emily Lebeau-Lucchesi about her book, This Is Really War, The Incredible True Story of a Navy Nurse POW in the Occupied Philippines. Stay tuned. Constant Wonder continues. I'm Marcus Smith. Thanks for joining with me for Constant Wonder. Our guest is Emily Lebeau-Lucchesi. She is author of This Is Really War, The Incredible True Story of a Navy Nurse POW in the Occupied Philippines. So Dorothy Still is one of the characters here. You've mentioned Peg Nash. I think we ought to mention at least one other nurse by name, Nurse Cobb. What yes. was her function, and why was she so important?
So Chief Nurse Cobb was about 50 years old when she was taken prisoner of war. She was originally from Kansas, and she was the head nurse. And she took her duty very seriously. So the nurses reported to her. She was responsible to reporting about her nurses to the fleet surgeon, to the admiral. And so she not only took that responsibility very seriously, but she took protecting her nurses as a responsibility, and she took that very greatly. So in any pictures, you always see that she's a little bit one step ahead of them. She's always doing very secret things to advance the welfare of her nurses But these secret things could have led to her own execution. So, for example, when they were first taken prisoner of war, the Japanese military was, you know, pillaging all their medicines, and she did not want to give up their malaria medicine. And so what she did is swapped it out with vials of baking soda. So when the medical officer came to do the inventory of the pharmaceuticals and take what he wanted, he took baking soda, thinking it was malaria medicine. And Cobb held on to those vials of, you know, quote unquote, baking soda for years, and was credited with saving many lives. So she was really a remarkable, quiet, but firm woman.
Can you describe sort of the accommodations? That's the wrong term altogether. But this is not like a camp built to be a camp. I understand there were university campuses that were put into service here.
Yes. And you know, it's interesting because I teach at the college level as well. And it's really, you just kind of cringe when you say how well universities are set up to be turned into prison camps. Because you don't want your students hearing you say that. But the reality is that prisoners could be divided into classrooms. There's a public announcement system which can be used to control the camp. So if I could give you a typical day at the prison in Manila, a typical day, the nurses were in a classroom. They had, you know, something like 10 by 8 square feet was their personal space. And they had to be responsible for coming up with everything, cots, mosquito nets, clothing. They were provided nothing. They woke up in the morning when the Japanese military used the PA system to play music and to wake the camp. And then if you wanted to use the facilities, you had to wait in line. Because there was about one toilet for every 106 inmates. And there was no partitions inside. The bathrooms were segregated by sex, but there was no partition. So you had to use the toilet or take a shower in front of other inmates as a method of humiliation. And then at that point, you would probably want to collect your very meager meal from what they call the camp restaurant. You had a punch card to entitle you to meals. And in the beginning, it was rice and perhaps a few vegetables or duck egg if you were lucky. And then you could supplement your meals, you know, trading with other inmates, getting packages from the outside. And then all of that stopped by the end because they were actively trying to kill the inmates. So they were getting about 500 calories every other day. And despite this, the nurses were going to the infirmary and doing as many as 12-hour shifts. Huh.
I have to ask you, were you surprised to discover that that nurses were pressed into service in this context? I mean, I don't know how people run this kind of a camp. I would have expected. I mean, I hate to call this common practice because there are no common practices in conditions of war, right? It's just like the Japanese are making this up as they go along, and they said, well, we've got these nurses here. We'll make them do the nursing work.
Oh, no, the Japanese did not care if they died. Like, they really did not care if there was any medical. The nurses volunteered, and that, to me, is what makes them so heroic, is on their first day. When they were taken prisoner of war at a woman's music college with the other members of the Naval Medical Corps, and then they were separated, and the men were sent to a military prison camp with and most of them died. The men they served with, the vast majority of them died. The women were sent to University of Santo Tomas in Manila. And their first day there, Chief Nurse Cobb organized them to go to the infirmary and provide services. And she said that she knew they did not enlist to serve civilians, and they were under no obligation to do so. But they did so out of duty. And so that was what was so remarkable, and that they carried that duty to Los Baños, which if the U.S. military had not raided the camp on February 23rd, 1945, that would have been their last day on Earth.
So essentially, this group of nurses, it was kind of an ad hoc effort to establish what the Japanese never provided in the first place, the infirmary. It wasn't the Japanese idea. It was their own group idea.
Exactly. Exactly. And what's amazing, too, is when they transferred to Los Baños, they were not allowed to bring any medical supplies. That was the rule. And so they ended up bartering a lot. They had a very hapless Japanese medical officer who was in charge of medical care for the 75-man garrison, and he had no medical training. And he kept asking the nurses for help, and Chief Nurse Cobb would say, well, we need insulin, or we need, for the diabetics, we need insulin, or we need bandages. And so she was able, for a little bit of time in 43 and part of 44, to get supplies in like a trade agreement. And then by the end of 44, as the U.S. began winning the war, all supplies were cut off in an attempt to kill the inmates. It became a slow motion death camp.
Mm-hmm. I've heard you say elsewhere that what you have attempted to do here, at least in part, is to get the story told before it kind of evaporates.
Yes.
Have you felt like there's like a window closing on this?
I mean, it's incredible because I was born in the 1970s, right? So I have absolutely no overlap with this time period. But what I do have access to is the records. And we never know what is going to come of these records. Will they still be available one day? And will people still care? And so I feel that I'm trying to make sure that we understand what happened to these nurses.
I have to ask, is this purely a story about American nurses? Were there also people that you learned about from the Filipino side of things that they were working in the camps in this way?
Well, so of the Navy nurses, the 11 of them were in the U.S. Navy Nurse Corps. And then the 12th one was actually a Filipina who married a naval officer. And then he asked Chief Nurse Cobb if she could join the ranks of the U.S. Navy nurses. And Chief Nurse Cobb brought her on. So she joined the ranks of the U.S. Navy nurses. And it's really remarkable because in all the pictures, she's in the uniform. The nurses all remember her as one of the group. But historically, there's been some problems with her being excluded. So I made sure to fix that.
Yeah. Well, I want to end kind of where we began, which was that after their release, that they were kind of told, don't talk about this and downplay the horrors of it. And you weren't the victims. The POWs are the soldiers or the men. They were actually paraded around for photo ops.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. And especially poor Dorothy. You know, Dorothy was about 30, 31 when she was released. So she was a young woman, and she was just beautiful, right? She was tall. She was slender. She had this very pale blonde hair and beautiful hazel eyes. And there was still a war going on. And so she was asked to speak at war bond drives. Because they came back in March of 1945, and the war in the Pacific stretched through the summer. And in fact, when she came and first began speaking, there was still a war in Europe. And so she was asked to speak about her experiences at war bond drives, and it was really traumatizing for her. She didn't want to relive it. At the same time, she also felt that no one could relate to her. People would talk about, oh, well, we had to deal with, you know, we couldn't have nylons and we had to have coupons to purchase meat. So we know about deprivation. And she'd think, oh, no, you don't. So it was really traumatic for her to have to go through these experiences.
So she writes her own memoir eventually, and I would imagine that that would address some of the need for her to find some kind of indication for what she'd been through. She dies in 2001. Do you feel like, Dorothy, at her passing, that people, at least a few people, understood who she was and what she'd done and what she'd been through?
No, I don't. It's really limited. Just super, super limited. One time her son tells me that she attended like a Navy nurse reunion, and they identified the Navy nurse POWs in the auditorium and gave them a big standing ovation. And then when she died in 2001, the Navy Nurse Corps gave her a beautiful ceremony. And so they acknowledged her. But it's interesting because her sons tell me that it wasn't until they read the book that they fully understood what their mother went through, that they fully understood her ordeal, and it let them know more of who she was. And they jokingly tell me that I know her better, even though I never met her. I didn't start researching this book until 2015. But I know this part of her life very well, and I want other people to acknowledge just how profoundly heroic these women were. I don't feel they get lumped in with the Angels of Bataan, and they never get their due. I feel like there's, every time you turn around, there's a new movie about what a man did in World War II, but there's never been a space to acknowledge these women. And that's disappointing to me.
And I suppose that part of the complicating circumstances here are that you can't trump your own horn with a story like this. There's just no way that the onus should be on you to tell that story,
right,
and make yourself out as a hero.
Yeah. It's amazing, too, because they didn't see themselves as heroes. But I can't tell you how many people have contacted me since the book came out and said that one of their parents was in either Santo Tomas or Los Baños, or both. And they were treated by the Navy nurses when they were sick. I've had people stand up and say, you know, they were a small child in one of these. It's really profound.
Yeah, yeah. I would imagine that when that circle closes and you get to hear that story, that would give me chills.
Oh, yeah. It really is. And so the people who were there know. The survivors, their children, know what these poor civilian inmates went through and what the Navy nurses did to keep them alive. And the fact that they didn't have to. If they'd wanted to stay in bed all day, they could have, because they had their own ailments. I want to stress that Peg Nash, who the title of the book comes from her, when she left Los Baños, she was 68 pounds and had undiagnosed tuberculosis. And Dorothy had a vitamin deficiency called beriberi. She was unbelievably exhausted, malnourished. Chief Nurse Cobb developed arthritis and a heart condition. One of the nurses had a heart attack in the camp. They had to have her appendix removed, right? So they would be patients as well. When they were in the infirmary towards the end, if they bent down to help a patient, they didn't always have the back or the leg muscles to right themselves. Mm. And yet they continued to provide comfort. And that's why they were the 12 anchors, because they kept helpless and ailing inmates from drifting. And I think that there's a lot of inmates who would have drifted from this world if they didn't have this Navy nurse providing kindness and comfort and anchoring them and saying, hold on, we're almost there.
Emily, such a pleasure to have a chance to hear this important and very challenging story from you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Emily LeBeau-Lucchese with us, and her book is titled This Is Really War, The Incredible True Story of a Navy Nurse POW in the Occupied Philippines. Some of the greatest heroism in the annals of American military history has occurred not on the battlefield with guns, but in POW camps with quiet service from one POW to another. When we return, we're going to revisit the story of one such hero, one who did not make it back, but the memory of his service and sacrifice very much alive. Stay tuned for more Constant Wonder. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. This hour, we're talking about lesser-known military heroes, not the kind of heroes who took out the enemy on the battlefield, but the kind who quietly healed bodies, minds, and souls as prisoners of war. We began with a conversation about some heroic nurses in Japanese POW camps in the Philippines. Now we're going to turn to the story of Emil Capon. Capon was an American chaplain who died in a Chinese POW camp during the Korean War, that often overlooked war. And that was fought from 1953, of course, to liberate today's thriving democracy of South Korea from communist takeover. To learn more about Father Capon, Emil Capon, Tenery Taylor of our team spoke with Joe Drape, who is a sports writer for The New York Times and author of The Saint Makers, Inside the Catholic Church and How a War Hero Inspired a Journey of Faith.
Father Capon was a son of a farmer in Pilsen, Kansas, a Czech Bohemian community, small town. He was one of the oldest of two. He was a farm boy. He did things that farm boys do, bring in the eggs, follow his dad around, hunt, fish, just did the hard work in the Depression that, you know, first generation immigrants did. Very early, he wanted to be a priest, and so much so that he made makeshift altars at his home and said imaginary masses, quickly went to St. John's Church, became an altar boy, and set his sides on it. You know, the interesting thing about him in his early life, there was nothing really remarkable about him. He was a bright kid. He went to seminary early, helped all his classmates, was a good guy by all accounts. And he came home to St. John's to be the parish priest, and that really didn't work out for him. The parishioners thought of him as Bessie and Emil's boy, so he didn't command authority. But he found his calling very quickly as an assistant chaplain at the nearby army base. And he enjoyed being around men his age. And again, Tenery, he was in his 20s at this point. Liked the physical activity of it. Liked being around him. He shipped off to World War II, won a Bronze Star over there. In fact, he's the most decorated chaplain in American military history. Came back home, again tried the parish priest thing, didn't really work out. The Korea War came out on, and as I discovered in my reporting, it was a short, brutal war, but he signed up, went over, and within, you know, two brutal years and short years, really distinguished himself as not only, you know, a man of valor and heroism, saving hundreds without ever picking up a gun. And, you know, that was recognized as a Medal of Honor winner posthumously in 2013 by President Obama, but really left this trail of virtue behind that had his fellow soldiers of all religions and stripes and faiths clamoring to get him made a saint in the Catholic Church.
And he died there as a prisoner of war. Just tell us briefly about, you know, who was fighting whom and who were his captors.
Basically, he came in early in the war. There was about 6,000 in his battalion and 25,000 Chinese troops showed up. This was really the emergence of China as a superpower. And it was beginning of the Cold War, communism versus democracy. He fought heroically. He had a reputation for taking a jeep through battlefields, foxhole to foxhole, carrying canteens, foods in his pockets. his crucifix, blessing people. He really wasn't too concerned if you're Catholic or not. He basically said, you know, you guys got time for a prayer. Quick prayer, moved on. Would never leave a wounded man behind. And that's where he really first got noticed. He would rush into these danger zones, load up his Jeep with as many as he can carry and bring them back. Within months, however, he got captured along with 600-700 other members of his battalion in just a massacre. And the Chinese were very brutal at this point, and they really didn't want to take prisoners. And if you were wounded and couldn't go on, you were left for dead behind. Right as he got captured, a Chinese soldier was trying to put down to death a wounded soldier who had wounds in his legs and his shoulder. Father Capon pushed Chinese soldier's rifle away, threw him on his shoulders, and said, "I'm going to carry him." And that really was the first act of defiance that rallied his fellow captors. They started picking up the wounded, and they went on this awful death march, month long, more than 60 miles, shoes and boots taken with no clothes and sub-zero temperatures to the place called the Valley of Death. And it was subsequently named Camp Number 5. And it was there that they lived in squalor, eating barely a fistful of bird seed is all they were rationed at that. And that is when Father Capon realized that, you know, it was much more important to keep hope and faith up, and he would do by any means necessary. And if that meant going and stealing food from the guards, he did that on nighttime raids. His farm experience came in handy. He was able to build tools so they could boil water, build latrines. If medicine, he'd siphon medicine from the doctors, fake dysentery, fake symptoms, so he could get there. And more than anything, he just kept some semblance of faith and religion and hope up. And that is something that really resonated with a rainbow of people. There were Turkish soldiers there who were Muslims. There were Jewish soldiers. There were Protestants. There were atheists. But everybody rallied around this fearless priest.
And were you able to kind of get the story from their side as well to see the impact he actually had on people who then made it out?
Absolutely. And in fact, to show you the impact, when the prisoners were released in 1953, a Jewish fighter pilot named Gerald Fink led the survivors from Camp Number 5 out, carrying a cross that he had spent months building with the likeness of Father Capon. And Major Fink never even knew Father Capon. He had gotten captured afterwards, but word and legend of his many, strengths and leadership had resonated that much. And they went straight to the newspapermen of that day and told the story of, the most brave soldier they ever served with. And, one of them had an article in the Saturday Evening Post months after he got released. There was a television show, sort of like the Hallmark Hour, that the actor James Whitmore played Father Capon.
I actually have a clip from that. It's called Crossroads. And Father Capon is kind of talking back to his Chinese captor in a courtroom setting. Here we go.
"Tell us, comrade, how many Russians have you given orders to?
Sit down. I'll have all of you punished.
What for, comrade? I'm just trying to help these men to understand the truth of your facts.
You're an obstructionist, Jew, in your church. Everything you say, everything you do. Ever since you've been here."
Father Capon was subjected to special punishments for daring to administer to the spiritual needs of his fellow prisoners. He had defied the Red Orders against holding religious services.
So there we've got Father Capon portrayed on TV, standing up to his Red Guard captors, talking back and then being punished for it. How did he eventually die there in the camp?
Well, and this resonates very deeply if you're Catholic. Being a saint requires imitating the life of Christ, living a life of such virtue that people want to imitate it. And Father Capon did imitate the life of Christ right down to his death. He had finally gotten sick and wounded. He had had a bad leg. Everything kind of went at once. And the Chinese couldn't wait to get him out and take him to what they called the death house. And that was basically a monastery where they just left you to die. And so they came for him, and his men rallied around him and rioted and trying to, you know, overpower the guards. And he said, "No, guys, how can you do this? I'm going where I want to be, and that's next to my Lord. And you guys need to just stay here and keep the faith." And as they carried him out on a stretcher, an honor guard was formed of his fellow captives. But on his way, he raised his hand, made the sign of the cross, and forgave every Chinese soldier involved there. And he finally asked the commandant who was putting him to his death to forgive him. So it really mirrored that last scene of Jesus on the cross.
Hmm. Now, there's another very important actor in your story that you're telling on the quest to make Father Capon a saint, and that is Father Hotze.
Father John Hotze.
He's what you call, what the Catholic Church calls, a postulator. Will you explain what that is?
Father John was the guy appointed at the local ground level in Wichita to gather, make the case for Father Capon as a saint, as a candidate for sainthood. And what he did was pretty remarkable. He was from that area. He had actually known of Father Capon, had a prayer card of his, was important in his life.
And okay, explain for us lay people, what is a prayer card? What does that mean?
A prayer card is a simple little size of a playing card, and it has five or six lines that asking Father Capon or whoever the saint, if it's Saint Christopher, to intercede on your behalf, to be remembered in your prayers. And, you know, Father Capon was about faith, service, and courage. Mm. And those were the three things you ask and you pray to him to help shore up with you. And Father John knew all this. He also had his master's in canon law, and that's an important component as this thing moves down the road. But essentially what he was tasked to do was go talk and gather testimony to anybody who knew Father Capon from 0 to 35 when he died. And he did such a remarkable job. And he spent 13 years doing it, and he amassed 8,672 pages of documentation on Father Capon's worthiness as a saint, as a man of virtue and a man of faith. And with that, you send that to Rome. And this was the second part of the book. The book's basically three parts, Denery. There's the biography of this remarkable priest. There's the process, which is often Byzantine and age old, of how you become a saint, which is merely considered a superhero of the Catholic Church. And the third part became an important part to me because I discovered I had the first two parts pretty good, but I was not in great shape with my spiritual relationship to God. And it was how Father Capon moved me a little bit to a more authentic way to approach it. So, you know, that's.
Yeah, I want to stop you right there because we're going to get into that, all of those things a little bit more later. But you're a sports writer, so this comes across your desk. How did you actually get connected with this story?
You know, divine providence, because in 2008, I moved my family to Kansas to write a book about a undefeated high school football team that had two rules: love one another and get better each day. Never talked about winning. It was rural Kansas. All my previous books have been about sports. And I was first introduced to that story of Father Capon. And it was people who looked like him and looked up to him. Just stuck in my head that was 2008, for years. In 2015, I got the opportunity. An editor asked me, "Have you ever thought about doing a non-related sports book?" And that was the first thing that popped into my head. And, you know, I gotta believe, looking back, that the hands of God were somehow at work there, because I was parochial educated. I did go to an all-boys Jesuit high school, but by no means did I consider myself devout or ultra Catholic. But again, you know, you get little pushes, and when you get that little push, you've got to follow them.
We've been talking about Emil Kapon, who is up for sainthood and the process of becoming a saint, and learning about his life story that actually has made him worthy of being a saint. Now, if you just kind of give us some background, Joe, about the role of saints in the Catholic Church. You know, you've explained a little bit about the prayer cards and that you pray to certain saints for certain needs. Just give me an idea of the role they play in people's lives and how many there are.
Tenery, there's about 10,000 saints. And, you know, I've come to refer to them as they're the superheroes of the Catholic Church. There's really two components that make a saint. One is a life that's worth imitating, a life of virtue, an extraordinary display daily of devotion. And the second and the most, to me, the important thing is relatability. We have to see a little bit of something of ourselves in them. That's sort of makes what the sainthood, that gives us something to not only shoot for, but we could say, hey, we're like them. He was like me. She was like me. And so those are the two components on there. And over time, the thing has evolved, and especially in modern times, Tenery, Pope John Paul II realized that this was an underused marketing tool, that you could reach more people if you gave them more relatable heroes and people to look up to. And he made 482 saints, which is more than all his predecessors combined.
Joe Drape is a devout Catholic, a sports writer for the New York Times, and author of The Saint Makers, Inside the Catholic Church and How a War Hero Inspired a Journey of Faith. Joe Drape was speaking there with Constant Wonder producer Tenery Taylor. And to hear the entire conversation, including a fascinating account of the process of how a saint is made in the Catholic Church, it's very easy to find us. Do an internet search for BYU Radio Constant Wonder, and then Father Kapon. Kapon is spelled K-A-U-P-O-N. When we say that somebody has invented something out of thin air, we're not flattering them. We usually mean that the whole thing amounts to nothing. But at least once in modern history, an invention out of thin air sparked a revolution in both munitions and in agriculture. And there were massive implications for good and ill, those implications still with us today. The creation of synthetic nitrogen out of thin air. That's our big story tomorrow. I hope you can join us. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.